I always have this, you know, when I hear Chris isn't going to be here, I'm always like, oh, and then he introduces these just gems to us, and what a gift to have you here, Josh. That was beautiful, and thank you, Chris. So good. Well, we're going to be continuing in our study of James today, and you know, to be completely honest, I ended up doing a wedding last night and getting home really late, so you're going to have to bear with me. The wedding started over an hour late, can you imagine? Hair and makeup, right? Like, it's a big deal, you got to get that right, I understand. But it's funny, I've been doing a lot of weddings recently, and I keep having this experience where, you know, over the years, these fathers walking their daughters just get more and more my age, right? They used to be these, like, older men walking their daughters down, and now I'm looking at them going, oh, that's me right there in this, like, reality of time moving on, and I just thought, oh, last night I was thinking, oh, my goodness, like, slow down. Time needs to slow down, but we know that it works just the opposite, doesn't it? It has this way over the years of getting faster and faster as it goes, and sometimes we have this startling moment when we look in the mirror and go, who is that? You ever have that experience? I came across this quote by the playwright Tennessee Williams. He says this, there comes a time when you look into the mirror and you realize that what you see is all that you will ever be. And then you accept it, or you kill yourself, or you stop looking in mirrors. There's some real wisdom probably in there. He's getting at this sort of painfulness of the truth, right? That we look in the mirror and go, oh, I was, you know, curious and looked up the statistic of how much we spend each year on cosmetic surgery, and $16.5 billion in 2018. That's a lot of money to try to get the reflection to look right, right? We're looking at it going, no, like, hang on, what can I do to fix this? And the fact is, there's an honesty that those mirrors bring that oftentimes is different than what we desire. And it creates a sort of struggle. What we tend to do in response to that is a little self-editing, or maybe we stop paying attention, stop looking. In James chapter 1, James is talking about wisdom, and he says this, be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he looks at himself and goes away and at once forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing. Now, what is James talking about here? This idea of a mirror is obviously it's a metaphor for the truth, the reality that's out there. You know, it's become common these days to talk about reality being something that we can sort of create or shape. But the fact is, reality has a stubbornness to it. I remember a teacher of mine one time saying, reality is what you bump into when you're wrong. Right? That it doesn't have this sort of amorphous flexibility, like we can mold it into what we want. No, we hit it and go, ouch, right? Reality has got this sort of bluntness to it. And how we respond to it says so much about ourselves, but also our trajectory and how we will grow, how we respond to truth. And I think if we're using today's terms, James is talking about self-awareness. We hear a lot written about this these days. How self-aware are you? What is your emotional intelligence level? And let me just ask this for curiosity's sake. How many of you would consider yourself to be self-aware? All right. How many of you are becoming more self-aware? All right. So statistically, this is right, that they would say, when asked this question, 80% of people will say they're self-aware. Now, to add another component to it, somebody close to you, they'll ask the same two questions. How self-aware is Jeff? And is he growing in his self-awareness? And it turns out this number, 80%, drops to 10% which means most of us are not only lacking self-awareness, but we're lacking the realization or the awareness that we lack self-awareness. We don't know that we don't know, right? And this is a problem, you can imagine, because we're all thinking, yeah, I think I've got a pretty accurate sense of who I am. When the truth of the matter is, most of us are living in a sort of story that we've created about ourselves, kind of a best version. And we put this forward. We could call it a veneer on our lives or a mask on our lives, a way of coming across. It's kind of our own marketing, right? We're constantly doing our own sort of self-endorsement or rebranding, and nothing like social media to add to the effect, right? There's an Instagram account that my friend Tom turned me on to that's called Influencers in the Wild. Anyone follow this? And it's this sort of meta perspective of like people filming themselves, right? And how silly we look as we're trying to create this image, right? But there's something about this, like lack of self-awareness, that I think James identifies and is saying on a certain level can be comical, even kind of funny, a way to laugh at ourselves. And yet, when it comes to matters of the heart, it can be extremely dangerous. That there are things going on, passions, motivations in our own hearts that create actions or a lack of action in our lives. And in our ignorance, we're doing nothing about it. We're not paying attention. And oftentimes the harm or effect of our lives, we don't even realize. We're going around thinking we've kind of got this figured out, when in fact, what's following behind us is chaos in our wake. That we're living lives that we consider to be righteous, when in fact, what it's creating is division. And this idea of our faith, right, is revealed in our behaviors, and it's revealed in their effect. That we might go around thinking we have faith, when in fact, James is saying, well, you have faith, but it doesn't have a pulse. It's dead. You're acting out these sort of rote behaviors, but the life behind it, the heart behind it is missing. And James is talking about how our lives are really this school of God bringing us to life, maturing us, leading us towards wisdom, towards completion, and in the end, towards purity of heart. And all of us are signed up for this school. It's not like an optional thing. You're in it. That the trials and the frustrations of your life, the difficulties of your life, are opportunities God is using to turn you in to the person that he created you to be. But how we respond has a massive effect. We were talking about this just this last week in the men's upper room, saying, does becoming a Christian make you wise? And the answer is it should. But the truth is, it often doesn't. That there's a work that God begins at that, and there's a salvation and a grace that comes. But that trajectory of becoming wise and coming to life is something that we continue to be able to participate in. And one of the ways we do it is by looking carefully at the truth and responding correctly to it, which is why wisdom starts with humility. It starts with surrender. It starts with fear of the Lord. And James speaks of this journey towards wisdom in terms of these kind of two polarities, right? He talks about a wisdom from above and a wisdom from below. And he talks about a wisdom that is heavenly and a wisdom that's demonic. That as we are growing, that there are these sort of two spheres that are on opposite ends that are pulling us either towards one or the other. But then when we look at our lives, our sort of everyday lives, you would think that the difference between a heavenly sort of wisdom and a hellish sort of wisdom would be clear. But he says, actually, they are not always so. But sometimes this true wisdom and this false wisdom can sort of mask themselves as one or the other. That it takes discernment to know which is which. And so it's not just enough to know the right thing or even to do the right thing, but the motivations of the heart become what reveals its true character or its true quality. Jay was teaching us last week from the end of James 3. And in that, James is going to say, here's kind of the tells. If you want to know if somebody's behavior, if their actions are false wisdom, look for these things: selfishness, ambition, jealousy, favoritism. These things give away that wisdom as the false sort of wisdom, the dangerous sort of wisdom, the toxic sort of wisdom. And then he says this, and I love this verse. It's, to me, it's such a great reflection of what he's getting at the heart of this. He says, the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Isn't that good? That's what wisdom feels like. It's what it's texture, right? Which is kind of an odd word, but you're going, it's a little bit hard to get around. Like, what makes it wise? Well, you know it by the way it tastes. The purity, the peacefulness, its effect. It's got a gentleness to it. Merciful, impartial, sincere, good fruits, right? It's filled with love and joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. This should be the effect of our life as we go through it. As he says, peacemakers, sowing seeds of peace that manifest in righteousness. If you want to know what you're called to, it's that. Every single one of you are called to be peacemakers in this world. And I think if we take an honest assessment of the effect of the church in today's culture, it doesn't always feel like that. Would you agree? That when people think of us, John's going to say they should think of you and they should think love. James is going to say they should look at you, they should think peace. This is the effect of Christ followers living according to what James calls the royal law, the law of freedom, to love God and love your neighbor. That's like the whole thing right there. And if we're not doing that, we're not doing the work. We're not stepping in to our calling. It's not enough to know the truth. The truth must be acted on, but the actions themselves need to be done with a heart that is healthy and pure. Part of the salvation work that God is doing is bringing our hearts more and more into this sense of oneness, this purity of heart, that our hearts belong to God, that his will is done here first. His kingdom begins here and then extends out to the world. And so in verse 4, you know, if you're like, or chapter 4, we're going to continue on. And if you're like me, at the end of chapter 3, I want to just go, got it, James, thank you. And he goes, oh, I'm not finished. He's going to keep pushing into this matter of the heart to the point where he's like, no, I want you to feel this, right? We look in the mirror and we're like, oh, got it, okay. And he's like, no, keep looking. Keep looking. Let this really soak in. Because in order for there to be true change, in order for us to move further into wisdom, we have to learn to accept the truth and see its effect for all that it entails. I'm going to read the whole passage, and then we're going to break it down into kind of three sections as we go. But we're going to read the first 10 verses of chapter 4. James writes, "What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. And you ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. You adulterous people, do you know that the friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that the scripture says he yearns jealously over the spirit that he has made to dwell in us? And he gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you." the word of the Lord. Like, whew, right? It's like a heavy one to swallow. And I think James knows that we're going to be like, yeah, yeah, fine, got it. And he's like, uh-uh. We're being scolded here. But again, I think when you pay attention to his language throughout, James is constantly using words of gentleness as he introduces these things, talking to them as his brothers and sisters, talking to them with generosity, and yet disciplining them. When Scripture says that God disciplines those he loves, we have to understand that this is a loving rebuke, and yet it's said with sternness. There's a real warning, and so often I think we trivialize these things and go, eh, it's no big deal. Now he begins talking about this war in our hearts, that we have these passions that we struggle with. And I think to understand, like, to get to the very root of it, you kind of have to go all the way back to the beginning of the story, all the way back to this garden where there's these two people there that are experiencing life as it's meant to be lived, a life that is meaningful, where they're cultivating and caring for the earth, and a life of intimacy and belonging, where they're walking in the evenings, in the cool of the evenings with their God. And everything's going just fine, except there's this tree there that's planted, tree with the knowledge of good and evil, that they're told is forbidden. It's my opinion that at some point they were to eat of that in the proper time, but I mean, I don't know for sure. But it's there. I don't think it's just like rat poison in the garden. But whatever the reason is, it's forbidden. The one thing that was off limits. And the temptation comes to them. Hey, you know, all this creative, sustaining power that God has to create this beautiful world and to keep it alive, turns out you don't need God. You can do that yourself. If you eat from that tree, you become this self-illuminating power source. In other words, independence, this prideful independence is at the heart of this false story that they're sold. And they take it, and what they do is they unplug themselves, disconnect, separate themselves from the source of life, and they begin to wither and die. Death enters into the garden. And this whole story of what unfolds is God restoring that relationship. But what is broken in that moment is their sense of purpose and their sense of intimacy. Those things, the choice of independence over those things, shatters those two things. And man, still to this day, is looking for a way to fix those two things, our sense of belonging and a sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. And as we do, we continue to this day to try to do those independent of God. It's just the effect that pride has. We want to take meaning and purpose and turn it into power and authority. We want to take belonging and turn it into self-adoration. And we come up with a whole system of behaviors to try to manage this like inner pain and brokenness inside of us. All these like behaviors on the outside, and James is saying, oh, no. Look deeper. Look into that heart and see the war that is going on. This daily battle happening there. And realize that in order to get control of this, we need to do some inner work. We need to pay attention. We need to look into the mirror, not just at our actions and behaviors, but at what's stirring even deeper there. In our thoughts, in our emotions, and all the spiral that's occurring. Paul writes in Romans 12, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good and pleasing and perfect will. And the renewing of your mind meant for the Jewish people, like your heart and your head. It was your thoughts and your emotions. And that so much like what's going on inside of us emotionally, what's going on inside of us intellectually, what we're thinking, is really just a mess. Would you agree? I think that we sometimes fail to see this. It's why we don't like to sit still, right? You hear me quote this all the time, but Pascal says the problem that we have is that we can't sit quietly in a room by ourselves, right? But why can't we sit quietly? Because this is what all of a sudden we see. The passions at war, the voices going on, the lies that we're told, the ambitions, the things of the heart, right? But to pay attention and to enter into that, that's where the work occurs. But instead, what we do is we rush to distraction. Things that alleviate that sense of disconnection from God, like achievement or status or popularity or influence. Don't those things feel so good, right? They're candy. They're this Turkish delight. They taste so sweet, and they last for about this long, and then they feel terrible afterwards. So you go looking for the next thing, the next way to offset the pain. We turn to games or entertainment. We turn to self-medicating practices, sex, partying, fitting into the inner ring. All of these things become ways of trying to fix the brokenness. All these ways of trying to, like, pacify the war in our hearts. But to get deeper than that takes work and intentionality. Proverbs 20, verse 5 says, "The purpose in a man's heart is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out." Those first three verses, what causes quarrels, what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war with you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. And James isn't specific about any quarrel, which means there was probably a lot of this going on in the church. Makes me think of this passion. Paul, when he talks in Romans 7, he says, "For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing." Does that sound familiar? "If I do what I do not want to do, it is no longer I who do it. It is the sin living in me that does it." Like, oh, at least it's helpful to know that Paul, too, is struggling with this. That this is the battle, and it's going to be something that all of us are probably going to chip away at for the rest of our lives. But we need to keep chipping away at it. This pride in us that's at the root keeps rearing its head, and we've got a devil that keeps egging us on. This from C.S. Lewis. He says, "Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, but only out of having more of it than the next man. It's the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest. Once the element of competition is gone, pride is gone." It's an interesting thing, right? That the way of the world is always this matter of scarcity. There's only so much. So when somebody else succeeds, we get threatened. When somebody has more than we do, we resent it. And it creates something deeper in our hearts, that resentment that can turn in the end into hatred. And if we're not careful, into a sort of violence internally. Why don't we ask God? He's saying, "You don't have because you don't ask." Again, that's us going like, "You know what? I think I can handle this myself. God, I'll check in when I really need you." Our first response, "I'm going to handle this myself." Until we get to the end of our rope and we realize that we can't, and then we start making deals. Like, "God, if you give me this, I'll stop doing this." Anyone ever prayed that? And every once in a while, God gives you that thing you're praying for, and then you just still go back and do that same stupid thing, right? And you realize, God knew. God knew. He gave it to me, and he knew I was going to still fall back into that. But these ideas, when we talk about self-awareness, I mean, this is how oblivious we are, is that we don't even realize we're trying to fool God with our motives. We're praying to a God that we think we can sort of talk into something. But we've got this God that knows our hearts and that loves us so much. And I think lovingly withholds oftentimes that thing that we're asking for because he's going, "Oh, if I gave that to you right now, it would wreck you. God, give me more power, more popularity. God, give me more money." I was sitting with somebody the other day, and not somebody from this church, I promise, but somebody that was sharing, like, Jeff, I've come into this, like, huge trust, and now there's all this money, and it's so difficult to know what to do. And I was like, huh, must be nice. Right? I thought that just for a second, and then I'm like, you know, I mean, all these things in us, this comparison, this kind of way of judging or looking at others, and why don't I have that? Like, God, give me that. And I think God goes, oh gosh, no, Jeff, are you kidding me? Like, let's be faithful with what I've given you, or whatever that is, right? But we're going, oh, no, I know it would fix this, God. And I think God so often goes, nope. I know that's what you think you want. Psalm 34, 17 to 18 says, the righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. And this idea, right, of God, what is he trying to do? He's trying to draw us back to this place of intimacy, which is where we thrive. This place of surrender, which is where we come alive. That feels like a temporary resting place or something to us. And God's saying, no, that's where you live. That's home. To be in that place of yieldedness, of surrender, regardless of whether you've got everything in control or your life feels like a train wreck. He's going, either way, it's Christ that will sustain you. That is who you lean on. That verse, that word in there towards the end where he talks about, you know, you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. And that word spend there in the Greek, it's the same word that Jesus is going to use in the prodigal son story, talking about the younger son wanting to spend his inheritance. It's to spend it in its own way. I want my money and I want to take it and I want to go do whatever I want with it. There's arrogance behind those prayers. And so James keeps going, you adulterous people. And realize that term, anytime that's used, adulterous people, it's talking about Christians. It's talking about people that are in the fold, who have left and strayed and gone away. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that Scripture says he yearns jealously over the Spirit that he has made to dwell in us? And he gives more grace, therefore it says, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Adultery, this unfaithfulness, right? When he's talking about this enmity with God, by choosing the world. He's talking about these two different ways of functioning, to respond in pride and self-promotion is to break this relationship with God. Lewis in Mere Christianity says, pride is the anti-God state of mind. It's opposed to it. To turn inward to the self is to turn away from God. Paul uses the phrase in 2 Timothy, we become lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Or John says in 1 John 2, do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. This doesn't mean that you can't enjoy things. It doesn't mean you can't participate in the world. It doesn't mean, like, go live in some convent somewhere and separate yourself. It just means we turn these passions or these desires into the thing itself. They become the first thing. They become the thing that we care about. They become the thing that we can't live without. And God is constantly trying to pull us back into this place of intimacy, to draw us back to that relationship that only he can fill, that belonging and the meaning and the purpose that we crave, we can only get in that place of coming into intimacy with our Creator. So God continues to pour out grace God continues to give. I was thinking, the picture that comes to mind is the giving tree. Do you know Shel Silverstein was asked when he wrote that book? Somebody said, write, tell me about who you think God is. And he wrote that book of this tree that just continues to sacrifice and sacrifice for this boy that it loves. And the boy constantly leaves, constantly goes away until this tree is nothing but a stump. And this old man finds a place to sit and rest. And the tree like sits up tall, like you can sit here. This is what the grace of God is like. But our independence is to constantly go away from home, to look for it somewhere else. And God is beckoning for us to return. This, James is trying to get us to see. He's saying, catch yourself doing it. See these behaviors in yourself. Be aware of yourself. It begins with this level of like acknowledgement, like there I go again. That if we don't see it, all this is happening internally and we just go through life completely unaware. But we have to see it and then we have to respond to it. And so in verse 7, he says, submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourself, therefore, before the Lord, and he will exalt you. Each of these times, he gives this stern rebuke and then goes, but God pours out grace. And here he's going like, go down, go down, go down. Let this break you so that God can exalt you. And this is the thing, that way down is the way up. And for us, we look at it and we see shame. Shame is the wrong response. Shame says you're bad. And James doesn't want shame. He wants guilt. Guilt says, I did something wrong. And so often in our self-editing, we refuse to own it, right? We go, yeah, but never would have happened unless this happened. Or you know the reason why I did that was because of this, right? It's not my fault. I'm the victim here. How much do we sit in the fullness of the guilt and let it do its work? A friend of mine that just got caught in sin. And he's fairly well known, so they're doing like a podcast thing about it as he's like talking about it, which is wonderful in all that honesty. But all of a sudden in the middle, he says, I want to make it clear, I was caught. So don't turn this into something noble. Because sometimes even we can turn humility into some form of pride. We're that sneaky and good at it. Or the devil too is that sneaky and good. Like, oh, look how humble you are. I was so proud of my friend for saying that. Like, I want you to really see it, right? I think James is going, you need to really see it. You want to get over this quick and you have that joyful expression. He's like, no, I need to see some tears. What is he after there? It's called contrition. It's to feel the weight of what we've done, to feel the guilt, to bring that before God and say, I'm so sorry. That is the way to freedom. God takes that and goes, stand up, right? Takes that load off of our shoulder. God comes into that place and lifts us back up. But until we're willing to come all the way down, for God to lift us back up, it's too soon. God is trying to get all the way underneath this inside of ourselves, all the way under that pride, all the way under that junk that's there, to create a heart that's his, a heart that is free, a heart that can thrive. That's what God sees when he sees you as his child. And he wants so badly for us to go home, but he's going to let that prodigal sit in that place of despair until he's desperate to return. And when that prodigal steps back home, the father runs out to meet him. I think the timing of this, you know, I keep talking about, we have this Ash Wednesday service that to me is a time of corporate confession. And sometimes we go, well, why do we need confession? We have grace. But confession is like what like makes room for all that grace to come in. I think God is pouring it on us, right? But we hold on to this space. When we self-protect, that grace sort of spills over. The more we get this stuff out of us, the more we lay it aside. And so this is why I actually really like the season of Lent, is that it's a season really of freedom, where you take something, not a sin in your life, but something that's got like too strong of a hold, and you lay it aside. Surfing. A couple of you are sweating just by me saying that. Don't surf for 40 days. Or take a break from social media for 40 days. Or that glass of wine at the end of the day. Or sugar, or Netflix, or the news, or whatever that thing is that you're like, oh, it's like your crutch. It's your go-to. It's the thing that you sort of look forward to. You set it aside, and you know what you're doing? You're thumbing your nose at the devil, saying it doesn't have a hold. And then you're taking and you're filling that space. That space in your life becomes an opportunity to just be with God. When those things in us stir, those dependencies, those anxieties awake, we go like, oh, God. The verse, my verse right now that I just is always coming to mind, and I love it so much, is from Isaiah 26:3. You keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you, who trusts in you. You keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you, who trusts in you. And this is how we come back into that place, as these spaces created in our lives. We keep our minds stayed on Christ, that he is enough, that he is where those longings, those passions are fully realized, and the belonging that I desire, the meaning that I want for my life is only found in that place of having my mind stayed on Christ. And what comes? Peace. And with that, the ability to sow seeds of peace in others, to create righteousness, a garden of righteousness. As we kind of come to a close, I was thinking about a couple things. First, I was talking to Steve Krantz the other day, and Steve has such a burden for prodigals. And he was saying, I would love for us to be able to, as a church, spend some time. And I was thinking, oh, that would be a great thing for us to do corporately as a church for Lent, is to pray for each other, for the prodigals that we know, the people that have left and haven't returned, the people that we know like need to come home but haven't. And so I was thinking this, that and you could come hand these to me this morning, but if there's somebody like that that is on your heart, if you want to write their name on a blue card and give it to me this morning, and then on Wednesday, we'll just hand them out to whoever would like one. So you can like even write the name confidentially if it's somebody that we know. And somebody else will take that for our Lent practice and pray over that every day for Lent. A way of holding on to that person that we care so deeply about, that God would continue to bring them home. And this, I think, is undergirding what James is longing for as a church, experiencing the life that Jesus had brought for them. I want to read this from Henry Nouwen, and it's from his book, The Return of the Prodigal Son. He says, for most of my life, I've struggled to find God, to know God, to love God. I've tried hard to follow the guidelines of the spiritual life, pray always, work for others, read the scriptures, and to avoid the many temptations to dissipate myself. I've failed many times, but always tried again, even when I was close to despair. Now I wonder whether I've sufficiently realized that during all this time, God has been trying to find me, to know me, and to love me. That's so good. The question is not how am I to find God, but how am I to let myself be found by him? The question is not how am I to know God, but how am I to let myself be known by God? And finally, the question is not how am I to love God, but how am I to let myself be loved by God? God is looking into the distance for me, trying to find me, longing to bring me home. And this way of turning those roles around to coming into this place of surrender, I think really in the end, this place of contrition, this place of helplessness is to say, God, come find me. And what we find is a God who's longing to do so. David prays these verses so bravely, search me, God, know my heart, test me and know my anxious thoughts, see if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So here's your questions as we close. Number one, take some time this week to sit with that simple prayer. Search me, know me. What is God revealing to you about your own longings and beliefs that are out of alignment? Number two, take time to really see it before you justify it or defend it or blame someone else. See it for the poison that it is. I think it's Teresa of Avila that says, sit in your weeds with God. Three, ask God for forgiveness for it. Receive his grace. And then go and ask forgiveness from those who have experienced the negative effects. Go and make it right. Go and sow seeds of peace. And number four, begin to replant the garden. What seeds of peace is God asking you to sow? What action might you add to your life that will begin to bear the fruit of true wisdom?